The soul's illusory attempt to compete with the Lord is known as tamizra, or darkness. So the attempt to compete with the Lord. Such a mood dictates that he must forget his eternal relationship with Krishna, otherwise it would be impossible to compete with the Lord. Trapped by that ignorance, he then acquires a material body and identifies himself with it. This is called under-tamizra, or complete blindness, that leaves the soul in darkness. A form of ignorance based on tamas. So there's tamizra, that illusory attempt to compete with the Lord. Under tamizra, which is complete blindness, you know. Tamizra describing one's, competing with the Lord, or this state of envy, you know. Under tamizra, he forgets himself also, and acquires a material body and identifies with it. So under tamizra is a complete blindness, as he describes. It's a form of ignorance based on tamas, which is ignorance of his true identity. So this tamas, or say forgetfulness, ignorance of one's true identity, is connected with this under tamizra, or complete blindness, that leaves the soul in complete darkness. State of darkness. Now, the bodily identification leads to physical and mental attachments, and therefore moha, or illusion, increases. Which in turn causes him to make materialistic endeavor and to view others either as friends or enemies. This only increases his desire to enjoy matter, and he gradually becomes mad after such enjoyment. To maintain the spirit that life is meant for his own pleasure, he requires all the forgetfulness that ignorance can supply, including forgetfulness of impending physical death, forgetfulness of his previous failed attempts to enjoy, and the frustration he felt in their wake, and forgetfulness of all the failed attempts of the countless souls before him. He must especially forget his own insignificance. This form of ignorance is called mahamoha, or great delusion. So, you know, it's such a state of illusion that it's basically great delusion or madness. To be so mad after sense gratification, you have to, be in a state of madness where you forget, so many things. Just like, when people sometimes commit murder or something, and it's considered that if they're in a state of temporary madness, it's understood that that state will make them forget everything that they need to remember, otherwise they wouldn't do that act. And it's a fact that sometimes that happens due to extreme stress, shock. So that state is mahamoha. So there's forgetfulness of the relationship with the Lord, forgetfulness of one's own self, identification with the material body, entanglement in the illusion that comes with, identifying with the material body, and then complete, madness in that illusion. So they're the five basic stages there. So it's a nice summary. And he concludes, these five forms of ignorance are necessary prerequisites for material life. no soul can approach the idea of enjoying independently from Krishna without them. Which is interesting. I had a friend of mine who is a devotee in New Zealand, and he would say to me that since becoming a devotee, he became depressed because he wanted to enjoy the material world, and now that he has knowledge, it prevents him from being an enjoyer of the material world, so he becomes depressed. Because he still wants to enjoy the material world. So that knowledge, you know, the more that one is forgetful of that knowledge, understanding, the more one is able to dive in, you know, head first and be an enjoyer. That sense of Krishna consciousness prevents one enjoying independently from Krishna. Therefore, you know, it is stated somewhere in the Srimad Bhagavatam, I think it might be the 11th canto, that actually it is the neophyte transcendentalist really who are the only persons who suffer. Because those who are actually transcendental, they come to the spiritual platform so they enjoy. Those who are on the material platform think they're enjoying, even though they're suffering, they take their suffering as enjoyment. So they're also enjoying. But the neophyte transcendentalist who knows that they're suffering, they know that enjoyment in the material world is actually suffering, but they haven't able to derive the taste from the spiritual life, they're the ones who suffer more than anyone. Yeah. Yes, in Kali Yuga, yes, that's right. It has increased to that. Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, very, very serious situation. It's sort of different from the, you know, occasional fall downs that you may have of people who are situated in the Vedic society. You know, they may have their problems here and there. You know, in this day and age, it is a constant state of, you know, a frantic attempt to enjoy sense gratification. they're mad after sense gratification, absolutely mad after sense gratification. So, we also heard that Brahma threw off his body of ignorance. The Yakshasas and Rakshasas seized it. They went to devour Brahma. Brahma produced the chief demigods, shining with the modes of goodness. So the Yakshas and Rakshasas seized the shadowy body of Brahma in the sense that, you know, produced from his so what happens, of course, is that from Brahma's mentality, the living beings and the bodies suitable for them are produced. Those in the modes of ignorance, yakshas and rakshasas, and the particular bodies, and then in the modes of goodness, the demigods and the bodies that, you know, suit them. From the buttocks, demons who attacked him for sex. Modes of passion there. The demons saw the twilight. That body was cast off and took the form of twilight, which they saw as a beautiful woman, beautiful girl, and awakened their lust. And they seized her. From Brahma's loveliness, he manifested the host of Gandharvas and Apsaras. From his sloth, the ghosts and fiends, and from his navel, the Sajjas and Pitas. You know, there, departed ancestors who have you know, they don't have a gross physical form. From his power of invisibility come the siddhas and vidyadharas. From his reflection, the kimparushas and kanaras. There's somewhat not quite human-like. You know, some of them are like bear or monkey-like, those races. From his stretched-out body came the snakes, and from his mind came man. The demigods and others praise the creation of man, who would please the demigods by acts of sacrifice. Lord Brahma, having equipped himself with saintly qualities, manifested the great sages. So finally the great sages were produced. So, you know, that's in that summary, which is actually in your student handbook. So we discussed most of that last week. Any questions on that? That was just a little recap, but is there any questions on that just before we move on? Hare Krishna. Yeah, can you call me back this evening? Yes. Just let me check my diary. Eight Andrew Road, Truganina, 3:30 tomorrow. Yes. Yep. All right. We'll see you then. Okay. I'll bring everything we require. Hare Krishna. Very, very good. Okay. Very nice. Yes, that's right. Okay. That's right. Yes. Yes. Okay. Hare Krishna. Thanks, so good. Yes.
We have a description of Lord Brahma appeared in five forms of ignorance.
Yes.
So, does it mean that Lord Brahma is beyond the three modes? He is not affected by mode of ignorance or anything like that?
Well, describes here. Well, Brahma's body is actually, in one sense, a manifestation of Vedic knowledge. You know, as we know, when Brahma speaks, the Vedic sounds, you know, all the Vedas emanated from Brahma. So that body he keeps permanently. That body, which is actually, you know, the epitome of pure knowledge, he keeps permanently, and this shadowy body he cast off. So, you know, and so these lower modes of material nature, which you know, were there, he cast off, and the purified, you know, body of goodness is there, you know, representing Vedic knowledge, and also because Brahma is in a relationship with the Supreme Lord, he also gets direct intelligence and knowledge through the heart. By the Supreme Lord himself. We hear that in the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Tane Brahma Vidaya. I know where to look when I need a confirmation of a sloka. Bhakti Sarva's done all the slokas. You know, how many slokas are there? 38 something. Whenever you want, you can come and recite the slokas to me and the translation, and I'll mark it. I'll mark you. So you can do one, you can do two, you can do ten. And rather than, you know, leave it all to the very end, and then you've got a couple of days to learn 38 slokas. So over the course of time, whenever you learn one, come. come and see me. I'll just listen, hear it, and we'll mark it.
So the translation has to be exact?
No, it's, you know, the Sanskrit, you know, like, whenever there's a little mistake, for instance, if someone, you know, says the Sanskrit with a little mistake but then corrects it, you don't lose marks. But if there are, you know, a few little mistakes, there may be some marks deducted from the Sanskrit if it's not corrected. The translation is not exact, no. It's you know, if the main points are there, you will still get the full marks. Yeah. But the Sanskrit, you want to try and get that as close as possible. So, yeah, does that, yeah, so, you know, Brahma is prone to be affected by the modes of material nature because he is associating with those modes of material nature, and because his you know, level of devotional service, although you know, far beyond you know, many devotees, but if we see in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, you know, there is a nice description by Sanatana Goswami, and he describes the levels of all different devotees. And you see that, you know, even above Brahma, the levels of devotees, and he gives the reasons why they're considered a higher grade of devotees. So, you know, there are many grades of devotees far and above Lord Brahma. Therefore, you know, to some degree, there are, you know, according to our level of devotion, of course, we are immune to the contamination of the material energy. So there is some proneness that Brahma may be sometimes affected. But by and large, predominantly, he is situated in the mode of goodness, and he is also directly receiving transcendental knowledge through the heart from the very beginning of creation from the Supreme Lord, which places him in a transcendental position. Alright, so that was just a little recap of last week. This week, that Vidura inquires from Maitreya about the descendants of Svayambhuva Manu. He mentions Priyavrata and Uttanapada and his three daughters, Devahuti, and then there is Akuti and Prasuti. Now, we know that Devahuti marries Kadama Muni. Kadama Muni is one of the sons of Brahma. And that Akuti and Prasuti marry Ruchi and Daksha. Ruchi and Daksha are also Prajapatis, they're also sons of Brahma. So, the three daughters of Svayambhuva Manu marry three of the sons of Brahma, and Svayambhuva Manu also has two sons, Priyavrata and Uttanapada. So we'll hear in this chapter how Kadama Muni practiced for 10,000 years penance. Pleased the Lord, who actually revealed his personal form to Kadama Muni. Kadama Muni asked for a blessing, and therefore the Lord, you know, did bless him that he would get a good wife to assist him in his service of as a Prajapati, progenitor of children, offspring. So what happens is Swayambhuva Manu approaches Kadama as foretold by the Lord at Bindu Sarovara, Kadama asks him about the purpose of his visit and promises to carry out his order. So, you know, gradually we see that he attains the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. So this chapter takes us up to the point of their meeting. So there's a couple of interesting comments made in the unveiling his lotus feet. Vidura, of course, being very enlightened and a great devotee, he's quite aware that Lord Kapila appears from Swayambhuva's line as the son of Kadama Muni and Devahuti. And you know, wishing to hear about the Lord Kapila, Vidura asks Maitreya to describe Swayambhuva's descendants in more detail. There are many wonderful descendants coming in the line of Swayambhuva Manu, the remainder of this canto, the third canto, is Maitreya's description of Devahuti's activities. Marrying Kadama Muni and giving birth to Kapila Muni. And then the descendants of Ikuti and Prasuti are described in the fourth canto, along with further descendants of Uttanapada. And, you know, we have such, including persons like Dhruva Maharaj, Preeti Maharaj, who's an incarnation of the Lord, Prachinabari Sat, and the Prachetas. Very famous. And then in Canto 5, Maitreya will discuss Manu's eldest son Priyavrata and his descendants, including Maharaj Rishabdev, another incarnation of the Lord, and his son Bharat Maharaj. So, you know, as a result of this these questions by Vidura to Maitreya, we'll actually cover will be covered in the third, fourth and fifth cantos, and some very famous personalities, the Lord and his devotees. Because Lord Brahma, we heard, had 10 sons. One of them, Swayambhuva Manu, his descendants. So, you know, here we're talking about Swayambhuva Manu. We'll also talk about his five children, two sons and three daughters. And the three daughters marry a son of Brahma. So that... That line from Swayambhuva Manu takes us right through the fifth canto. Very, very famous line. Very famous line, yeah. And of course, if I were to ask you, who are the two great sons of Swayambhuva Manu? Uttanapada and Priyavrata, yeah. Okay. And they rule the world consisting of seven islands, according to religious principles.
So there are both sons?
Of Swayambhuva Manu?
Only two, or?
It only mentions that he has two sons.
You said
ten sons of Brahma. Yeah. And three of those sons of Brahma marry one of each of Svayambhuva Manu's three daughters. Devahuti, Akuti and Prasuti. And they are, you know, Devahuti marries Svayambhuva. Ruchi, the son Ruchi marries Akuti, and Daksha marries Prasuti. Now, there's a in verses 6 to 12, we see that there is discussion, because Kadama Muni performs, you know, yoga, which is strongly mixed with devotional service. He performs that for 10,000 years. Now, we're asked to list some of the difficulties in practicing Astanga Yoga in this age of Kali, in verses 6 to 8 and 12 specifically. Generally, the great sages would first make their life perfect, and then they would beget children, otherwise they would be strictly celibate. So that's one of the difficulties. Prabhupada mentions in the purport to verse 4 that, you know, there's no recommendation. You can't enjoy material sense gratification at one's whims as one likes and at the same time become a great meditator. You've got to become a great meditator, and then you may, in that state of perfection, you know, generate good children, but you can't do both at once. So that's one of the difficulties which one will find in Kali Yuga, because people are trying to do that. In verse 6 we see that Kadama Muni meditated for 10,000 years, Valmiki meditated for 60,000 years. Now, who lives for that long? So they're going to have another problem there. That's a difficulty. As Prabhupada mentions, how people can be meditate for 15 minutes a day and think they're going to attain the perfection of becoming God? It's not going to happen. The other thing, of course, in verse 7, Srila Prabhupada makes a very strong point that one's efforts must be mixed with the process of devotion. You know, whether you practice yoga or, you know, jnana, or, you know, or you speculate, Kadama Muni's activities were dedicated to please God, so it must be mixed with devotion. If that's not there, that creates another difficulty for practicing Astanga Yoga. And of course, you know, as we described before, Kadama Muni, he's doing this in Satya Yuga. In Satya Yuga, and everyone lives for 100,000 years. So that's going to create problems in this day and age. And of course, in verse 12, we see that Srila Prabhupada mentions very nicely that, the yoga system described in the books of Patanjali is authoritative, whereas the modern so-called yogis, they manufacture their own ways. They don't consult authorities. And, you know, that makes their, not only makes their practice of Astanga Yoga difficult, it makes it ludicrous. Furthermore, even in the Patanjali system, it's understood that, one is practicing Astanga Yoga in order to come to the perfection of seeing the Lord face to face. If one becomes diverted by other goals, one cannot make further progress from that point. So one is, you know, performing Sangha yoga to have a beautiful body, to increase one's sex life, you know, to, you know, remove your asthma, to, you know, make your back not so sore, what have you. Then, you know, one will be diverted. One cannot make any perfection from that point. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I did write down some dates for you. I tried to call you yesterday. Can I just give them quickly? I'm actually giving a class, but if you like, I'll give them to you, and you can consider them. And if you can call me back this evening. But I can't talk with you very long. Just straight now. I just. Okay. Wednesday, the 30th of May. Friday, the 1st of the 6th, or Wednesday, the 13th of the 6th. The first one was Wednesday, the 30th of May. Friday the 1st of the 6th, and then Wednesday the 13th of the 6th. Alright, so I can discuss a little bit later with you if you have a think about those. Thank you. Usually in the morning is good. Alright then? Okay, Hare Krishna. So, you know, so on that matter of speculation, where that finishes off that conversation, it ties in with the next question, that how does a Krishna conscious person accept the form of Krishna as described in the Vedic literature? So others are not, you know, because they're manufacturing their own goals, their own processes. But a Krishna conscious person, they take them directly and they act upon them. Also propagate them. That's the difference. You know, the form of Krishna as described in the Vedic literature, you know, which is there even in the Patanjali. As Prabhupada mentions in his purport, the Patanjali system is a system of, you know, where one, the personalist, one actually approaches the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But impersonalists have changed the philosophy and spoiled everything. Now Patanjali was, I don't know the age of Patanjali, like how long he lived or what have you, but he is a contemporary with Srila Vyasadeva. But I don't know, you know, like these sages lived for a long time, but at the time of writing the Patanjali Sutras, he was a contemporary with Srila Vyasadeva. What's that? He was recommending that the goal of the Vedas is to attain the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the best process to do that is through Astanga Yoga. There are six different philosophers, of which Srila Vyasadeva is one, and those six different philosophers take a different stance on what the ultimate goal of Vedic knowledge is. So Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Vedic knowledge. We have to understand, of course, that Vedic knowledge existed since the beginning of creation. Srila Vyasadeva wrote down that knowledge 5,000 years ago, and he then compiled the Vedanta Sutra, in which he said that the goal of all Vedic knowledge is bhakti, is to practice pure devotional service to attain the perfection of reviving one's eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and go back to Godhead. So this is there in his Vedanta Sutra, in his commentary to the Srimad Bhagavatam. Other persons who are also aware of the Vedic literatures, even before Srila Vyasadeva wrote them down, have a slight different emphasis on the process and the goal of the Vedas. And that is because within the Vedas, those six different processes are actually there in a stepping stone fashion. So, for instance, to understand the Vedas, first of all, one needs to know the science of logic and reason and grammar, which is called nyaya, which is propounded by Gautama. So, you know, to understand the Vedas, first you actually have to understand the science of logic, reason, grammar, thinking. Mm-hmm. You actually have to think properly, you know, in a reasonable way, and to be able to, you know, communicate that knowledge in order to understand anything. So that's the science of logic. So that's part of the Vedas. But some take that science as literally, if you're, you know, persons who, you know, cannot extend their knowledge beyond that, take that as literally the goal of life is to be perfect in the science of logic and, you know, understanding knowledge for the sake of knowledge and teaching. Anyway, then, you know, from that there is the science of atomic theory, which is propounded by Kanada, I think his name is. What's Kanada? Kanada. Kanada. You know that everything rests upon atomic particles, which it does, but of course they don't, you know, one who understands the Vedas fully will also understand there are other teachings in the Vedas about spiritual particles. But of course, if one's intelligence doesn't rise to that spiritual platform, one can only understand that, you know, the particles, all the, you know, that are there in the Vedic knowledge, they can only understand it in a material way. They may only think of things in terms of, you know, all particles are material. But actually the Vedas are discriminating that, you know, there's a spirit soul, there's a super soul, that some of the particles are indeed spiritual. So there is logic, there is, you know, atomic theory, Sankhya, right? That, you know, the Sankhyas, they analyze that, you know, within material creation, there is 24 different elements. So, you know, when you mix the different atomic particles, it actually forms 24 different primary elements. Sankhya literally means counting. The word Sankhya means to count. So you count all the different primary elements. Now, when we hear about the teachings of Lord Kapila, he will describe the full understanding of Sankhya, which is that apart from the 24 material elements, there's also the soul, the super soul, like this. So, whereas the impersonalist Sankhyites can only understand things in a material way. Then, of course, there is the process, you know, of for one who understands that there are 24 material elements and also spiritual elements, how do we come to perceive the spiritual elements, therefore one takes up yoga. So there is the Astanga Yoga system. So one will take up the Astanga Yoga system of Patanjali, and one can literally fix one's consciousness upon the spiritual elements, the soul, and if they have more knowledge, the super soul. You know, through process of meditation, separating from matter from spirit. The Sankhyites can, you know, by knowledge separate matter from spirit, but the Astanga yogis literally realize that spiritual component through meditation. and they realize their spiritual senses. Now, then one may realize, oh yes, there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead or a super soul. One may take up the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, where one actually worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But generally, worshipping the Supreme Lord along with the demigods, the difficulty is that the materialistic philosophers, who again don't understand the full aspect of Vedic knowledge, they understand that, you know, they still don't understand the spiritual element, and they take the demigods as being the highest power, and that if you work properly, the demigods are obliged to give you the result, and therefore the ultimate highest power is your own work. So, you know, why worship God? Why worship anyone? Just do your work properly and the demigods are obliged to give. but actually, you know, the Karma Mimamsa should in fact be beginning to worship the Supreme Lord through Vedic rituals. Gradually they will come to understand that the Supreme Lord, who is above the demigods, is a transcendental personality beyond material creation, and that the soul within the material body is also a transcendental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord's energy, and that they have an eternal relationship, and therefore one will take up bhakti yoga. And that is the sixth aspect of Vedic knowledge. So all those aspects are actually there. But because persons cannot go beyond understanding one level, they say that that is all in all. So therefore that those who follow Astanga yoga, they cannot rise above that point of yoga and, attaining even mystic cities by which they can enjoy in the material world. They're not understanding. No, leave the material world and go back to the spiritual world. That's when that understanding is there, one takes up bhakti yoga. So these are... These philosophers were all contemporary with Śrīla Vyāsadeva. You know, existing before he wrote down the Vedas. And they had awareness of Vedic knowledge, but in some cases their awareness may be complete in themselves, and in some cases, as described in the Bhagavatam, it actually describes that, you know, their understanding was somewhat incomplete, actually. Although later some of these personalities actually become perfected, but at the time of writing this knowledge, it describes that there was some aspect of speculation on what the ultimate goal of the Vedas was. And therefore, although they're giving some Vedic knowledge, it is not... it's not giving the complete, six systems of apta bhakti. They're giving emphasis on one aspect. So that is some speculation to think that there is nothing beyond that. And of course, their followers, because they're not taking up bhakti yoga, then they will have even less understanding, and they tend to distort the teachings, which are already a slight distortion of the full understanding of the Vedas. See?
Today,
they don't even follow Patanjali. Today, they're not even following, anything. Yeah.
Most yogis will follow Patanjali.
Yes, that's right. Yes, but they, as we see here, they can't. They were somewhat aware, but their realization was certainly not full. So there was some awareness, but there is some element of misunderstanding. And Srila Vyasadeva literally wrote down the Vedic literatures and gave the conclusion in defiance of their philosophies. To literally, so therefore, if you read the Vedanta Sutra, he literally defeats the fact that any of these other five schools of thought or philosophy are actually giving the conclusive truth. His Vedanta Sutra literally defeats them point by point, and then presents the bhakti like that, and then. Just to make sure that people understand this very concise philosophical work, he expanded it in the Srimad Bhagavatam under the instruction of Narada Muni to make sure that persons, you know, with all the different discussions going on, that people understand, well, here is the last word. You know, that one should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is Lord Sri Krishna, and one worships him through the process of Bhakti Yoga. And the example, the best example of those are the Brajavasis, and there are all other examples of devotees leading up to that. so, you know, generally people don't state that. You know, even Vyasadeva didn't state it, and therefore Narada Muni was a little bit, you know, he chastised him. You know, he was smiling. You know, such a great sage, you know, so much knowledge. And still I have to chastise you. You haven't directly said Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, just say it plainly and straight out. And Srila Prabhupada says that also about, you know, if you read any of the editions of the Bhagavad Gita before Srila Prabhupada, even, you know, even others after that are not in the line, no one says, because actually Prabhupada read them. No one, even Gandhi, you know, Aravinda, Dr. Radhakrishna, this one, that one, very famous. You know, most people in India read Aravinda, this, you know, Dr. Radhakrishna, this one, that one, you know. Prabhupada says none of them just directly says Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and we should worship him. They don't say that. It's just a direct statement that everyone needs to hear. Before Prabhupada, you know, writing the Bhagavad Gita and then spreading that around the world, any other information which came out of India, no one ever said that. So it's just the most important statement you need to hear. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are, you know, a tiny spirit soul. We should worship God, and God is Krishna. You know, no one says that. I gave a Sunday feast class, and I asked everyone to describe the book. You know, what the book rests upon, what is that, pulpit, or whatever you call it, bookstand. Yeah, you go. And there people told me, oh, it's made out of wood, it's nicely carved, this, that, and the other. And when they'd all finished, you know, they went for ages, you know, the one thing that no one mentioned was, you know, who it belongs to, you know. And it's similar with the material world. People can say so many things about material creation, you know, atomic theory and, you know, the 24 elements and so many things. But actually the most important thing is who does it belong to? You know, he's God. You know, you see a car. You know, we know you can, you know, oh, beautiful car, I'll get in and take it for a run. But, you know, you can't do anything until the first thing you've got to know is, who does that belong to? What permission do I have to do anything with it? You know, and that's it. So, that's the beauty of Prabhupada's preaching. But sometimes, Srila Prabhupada preaches, you know, he just makes a simple statement. Krishna is the Supreme Person, I've got it, and we should worship him. And we think, oh, you know, I want to hear some big philosophy. And all the big philosophers can't make that simple statement. You know, there's so many big philosophers, and they can't make that simple statement. You know, therefore, Srila Prabhupada's preaching is very deceptive, even amongst his followers. Sometimes people want to jump over, but actually, you know, that's the wonderful thing. You know, when you hear Srila Prabhupada giving interviews, lectures, that he tries to state the most obvious, important, significant factor about what needs to be said. He doesn't try to just, you know, show, you know, be very showy with knowledge and, you know, oh, I know so many slokas, I can quote these slokas and I can tell you this. That. He just, you know, what should be blatantly obvious, which no one ever speaks, he just straight out speaks it. And that's the beauty of Prabhupada's preaching. So, that's a little rundown. And in this, you know, part of the Bhagavatam, we do start to get into, you know, some Sankhya Yoga and Astanga Yoga and there's Karma Mantra and all these different things come up, and that's how they fit in to the Vedas. You know, it's like that answer to, you know, question 3. How does a Krishna conscious person accept the form of Krishna? It should be as described in the Vedic literature. I think it says is described. Yeah, as described. The very simple answer, he accepts it directly. But, you know, you ask anyone else that, oh, you know, you can ask anyone else, oh, well, you know, it's all subjective. I think, you know, everyone can put their own you know, that's the most standard answer. Everyone can put their own. The obvious answer, no one will say. You just take it directly. Yeah. There's a beautiful Prabhupada's purpose. That's another example. Okay. What's that? It actually does take a lot of humility. And, you know, this is one of the things that you notice about young devotees is that they always want to do something different to the older devotees. Because, you know, if someone says, you know, just do like this, very simple. And they think, well, if I just do the simple thing you've asked for me, who's going to notice me? Or, you know, where's my credit? How will people recognize my great intelligence and my creative flair like this? So I think I'll do it slightly differently. And I think I'll speak in a slightly different way. It's very difficult for them to just take the simple procedure or to speak the simple statement. So you find very, very common amongst young devotees is that if you give them a simple task, they'll do something else.
I just saw on Facebook like some of the discussions from a young devotee,
yes,
a simple statement with a lot of added ideas.
Oh yeah.
Aren't actually stated.
Yeah.
One occasion I entered into a debate.
Yeah.
And with a barrage of responses.
It's,
I haven't done it since.
Yes.
But it's like a trendy way to say something.
Yes,
like
that's right.
Cool,
yeah.
Or in, or trendy,
yes, that's right.
Fashionable.
And
if you just say, hang on a minute, it's not like that. That's not what...
Yeah.
Well, this was a discussion on what is chanting.
Mm.
And, you know, sticking to action Vedic texts, I've made a reply to the regrettable waste of time. But anyway, it was just an exercise.
That's right. I did it once only. Someone asked a question, and I thought, well, I'll just give Prabhupada's answer to that, the standard answer.
Yep.
And when I gave the answer, even senior devotees were right back, I think, and in my opinion, like, and I'm thinking, what is this my opinion and I think? Prabhupada says, just to direct, what is going on there? And I just pulled out of it. I
never
to
do it again.
No, I. So, actually, it takes a lot of humility and a lot of realization to, you know, just follow in the footsteps and, you know, to say Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we should worship Him, and, you know, the very simple statements, but they need to be said. And you, in one sense, you don't get as much credit because you're not saying something that's attracting a lot of attention amongst, you know, the philosophers in the temple, or the, you know, the those who are very expert in so many different things. But you actually do attract the attention of Prabhupada for, you know, doing what he wants us to do. Now, this next section is very interesting. We'll spend a little time on it. The question of marriage and ISKCON. We're not going to go, we'll probably go till about 3:45 or something like that. You know, we won't go right till 5 because I've got to do some work for the Abhishek. Fortunately, Srimurti is pretty much doing 90% of what I should be doing. So I get to sit here and speak Krishna Katha with everyone here. which is, you know, it's interesting because you know, this part is about how husband and wife should, you know, cooperate to make a nice life. You know, it forms a nice basis for Krishna consciousness. Who's read this section from, say, questions from text 13-17? About Kadama Muni's sees the Supreme Personality of Godhead and then asks, you know, for the benediction of getting a good wife. So who's read that? Let me just show hands. Yep. What's that? The question? Yeah. All right. I'll just summarise that. It's a very interesting sect. What did you find about it, Paul, when, you know, reading this? Did you find... What's that?
It's an amazing wealth of knowledge and realizations from Prabhupada.
There's, yeah, there's a lot from many different angles of vision. It is mind-boggling, that's right. Because you sort of, you approach it, you feel that first, in Krishna consciousness, it's good to, you know, enter into the Grihastha ashram and, you know, to have a nice relationship, and you know, this is a good basis for, you know, spiritual progress. In another sense, Kadama Muni is condemning himself that, you know, here I am, I'm face to face with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and I'm asking him for something which, you know, basically is enjoyed by the lower species of life. You know, and he condemns himself as, you know, so it appears contradictory.
Yes.
That he himself praises what he's doing and also condemns it, and the Lord's response is also not straightforward to understand. I mean, it's easy to understand. Just like 2 + 2 = 4, that's easy to understand. But according to our level of consciousness, it can be difficult. Actually, Prabhupada makes that statement. Actually, Krishna consciousness is very easy. Sometimes his disciples would say like that, Prabhupada, that, you know, you just, what you just said is so difficult to understand. Prabhupada said, no, it's very easy. It's actually quite easy, but according to our level of understanding, we may find it very difficult. And this section is a bit like that. So, what's that? So let's give an example. I'll ask you something. If someone come up to you, right, any one of you here, a young person in Krishna consciousness. Now they're wondering whether to stay in the Brahmachari ashram or take a full time life in an ISKCON temple, or to become a Grihastha. They read through Kadama Muni's prayers in this section and they get confused. Yes, that's right. Yes, so you can. Yeah, that's why he's confused. So, would anyone like to steer that young person in the right direction? What's that? So if they become a Grihastha, is that a symbol of their commitment, or?
If that's what they need to do, then they can make a Krishna consciousness.
Or is it a better sign of their commitment if they remain Brahmachari?
Well, if they can do it, that's great.
That's more committed? Is that more committed?
Is it more committed?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
It is, yeah.
But maybe there's no meaning for everyone. Depending on where you are.
Any other thoughts on that? And anyone would like to add to that? Or
if making an intention to the government of Sunday, spending a few years in a Brahmachari ashram would actually make you more fixed up?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Or maybe he will completely do away with the desire to go into the Grihastha ashram.
If he does a couple of years in the Brahmachari ashram, he might then decide not to become a Grihastha. Yeah. Yeah? That's a fact, yeah. So, is his, is the person's wanting to, what do we understand about a person that they want to become a Grihastha? What do we think about that devotee, or, he wants to become a Grihastha? What's happening to him? What's up? Okay.
The requirements to be a Brahmin doesn't mean that it's any less, because everyone, whatever their particular attributes are, can contribute, and that's what the whole Vanashram.
That is what the Vanashram. They can still be a Brahmin, of course, in as a Grihastha. But yes, it's a very valid point that just like when people get an education, they don't all become doctors, because we need some mechanics, we need some, people who fly planes, we need people that, they're all required. Every single one of the persons in all the different occupations, bona fide, they're all required. If everyone just become an accountant or IT, that's what happens now, everyone does IT. But, yeah, it can't happen. Someone's got to cook, someone's got to grow the food. So, yes. So, according to one's natural, propensities, any of the different services which one is most suited to is the most practical. One becomes Grihastha if one is suited to that. Otherwise, if there's no Grihastha, there's no children. There's no children, there's no more. When this lot of Brahmacharis grows old and dies, there's no more.
I think if I recall, the Prabhupada does actually end up condemning Krishna.
Yes. That's right. Yes. So, would anyone like to condemn it? Would you have some? You want to repeat something that you read there, or?
A quote from that.
Yeah, something. Like. But just off, you know, off the cuff, what you can remember. because some of them are not. Some people are not necessarily saying this is my propensity to, you know, I can act as a traveling sannyasi or I can act as a grihastha. I'm suffering from a problem of wanting sense gratification, you know, and you know that can be there as well. In which case, as you know, when that's there, as Paul's saying, it's mentioned. You know, the Kadama Muni is actually mentioned, that is a lack of, you know, sufficient intelligence or brain substance. So then, you know, so these things are both in there. You know, so it can be a little confusing.
So you accept your lot. Oh, I'm missing a bit of pain substance.
What's that?
You accept your lot. I'm missing a bit of pain substance, and then you go outside ashram for more spiritual medicine.
Actually, that's mentioned that, you know, as one of the questions that we are actually asked. Question 7, why did Kadama Muni want to enjoy material life in spite of his personally seeing and experiencing the Supreme Lord? In verse 16, it describes that Prabhupada says that the answer is that not everyone is competent to be liberated. It's a fact. You know, we have to... You know, this is a very interesting... you can't get ahead of yourself. Yes. It's a very important instruction we're getting here from Kadama Muni. The son of Brahma, he's performed yoga and bhakti yoga for 10,000 years. So much, please the Lord so much that the Lord personally appears before him, so qualified he is, you know, even in the bhakti, that the Lord appeared before him. And still, he understands that he shouldn't get ahead of himself and take a station in life of renunciation that he doesn't feel that he's completely qualified for. And you know, this is where, of course, you know, we have to be somewhat thoughtful in ISKCON. Prabhupada had a general policy, not his only policy on this, but it's one of them that's quite often stated, is that you keep the brahmacharis as long as you can, and all the women should be married. It's an unusual one, because if you keep the brahmacharis, how do you do that? But it's a dilemma. But still, it's proper that actually, you know, ISKCON should help the women to, you know, not have great delays in marriage. It's, you know, physically it's not good to, you know. Emotionally and for so many different reasons, and you know, for raising children and so many different practicalities. At the same time, if ISKCON doesn't provide husbands by, you know, then, you know, saying, oh no, you stay in the ashram, you know, so therefore there is always, of course, the idea there is that generally this desire to enjoy sense gratification, you know, to enjoy the company of the opposite sex, to make a family and to get into that sort of, you know, expanding the material side of life is so strong, there's always going to be candidates amongst the men, therefore it's good to have some restraint on them. If there's no restraint at all, no pressure for them to not follow that natural, how strong is it in men in Kali Yuga if Kadama Muni in Satya Yuga, after 10,000 years of becoming perfect in yoga and seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and still that propensity is so strong that he is saying, I should get married. What to speak of us in Kali Yuga, what defense do we have against that propensity? So therefore, there has to be some check or help, to push the men in such a way, keep getting more training in Brahmacharya. Don't too easily follow that path. We see here, Gautama Muni, he didn't too easily follow that path. He waited 10,000 years. He waited till he became perfect and got the blessings of the Lord personally. So it's not as if he rushed in. So it's the same policy in one sense. But we're certainly not asking the men to wait 10,000 years. Sometimes to ask them to wait 2 weeks. When they're ready to get married is very difficult. So, it's quite an interesting section. Now, we'll look at a couple of the points here. As he says in verse 13, he describes those who are actually advanced. They just want to see your transcendental form. That's their goal, nothing else. Now then in verse 14, he describes only persons deprived of their intelligence by the spell of the deluding energy will worship those feet with to attain trivial and momentary pleasures of the senses, which even persons rotting in hell can attain. However, Lord, you are so kind that you can bestow mercy even upon them. As Prabhupada points out, those material pleasures can be had by the hogs and the dogs. Kadama Muni is condemning the modern yogis. That you're so advanced, but you want the pleasures that hogs and dogs are seeking for. Don't consider yourself such a big yogi. So he's condemning modern yogis. They cannot become perfect with that sort of mentality. Hatta Midisha, those whose brains are spoiled. Prabhupada would sometimes say, they have cow dung for brains. We have a slightly different way of saying it in the West, but that's Prabhupada's very gentlemanly way of saying. They aspire for material enjoyment by perfection of yoga meditation. To aspire for material enjoyment from yoga practice, the person is a great fool. So he's really condemning it, quite strongly. They should aspire for nothing else but to cross over the ocean of nescience by worshipping the Supreme Lord. Right? As he stated in the verse. But he's saying, desiring to marry a girl of like disposition who may prove to be a veritable cow of plenty in my married life to satisfy my lustful desire, I too have sought the shelter of your lotus feet. So then he's doing exactly what he's condemning. So he's not proud of it. He's not proud of it. He's a little bit ashamed of that fact. A veritable cow of plenty. You got to be careful when you say your wife is a cow. In the Vedas, if you compare your wife to a cow, it's a very lovely compliment. In the West, if you compare your wife to a cow, you might get a brick thrown at you.
Yeah,
that's right.
Way.
Yeah, that's right. But
it's quite a common saying, she's a
That's right, yeah. But originally it had a whole different slant on it. You know, because cows were respected as the symbol of, you know, the blessings of Lakshmi. If you have cows, it's the very symbol that, you know, Lakshmi is literally living, you know, in your home. You know, in another sense, by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core indicates also by calling his wife a cow, he's also implying that he's a bull, which, you know, an animal with no intelligence. You know, so those, there's that famous verse in the 10th canto, those who identify themselves with the material body are like, you know, asses and cows. And, you know. So, of like disposition is very important. Prabhupada says, you know, that basically people should consult the horoscope of the boy and the girl to see whether there would be factual union in their psychological conditions. He said, nowadays marriage takes place without such consultation, and therefore soon after the marriage there is divorce and separation. Formerly, husband and wife used to live together peacefully throughout their whole lives, but nowadays it is a very difficult task. So, you know, Prabhupada is, again, we hear many different statements where, you know, even as devotees, they have usually just one quote about astrology in a very derogative way. Here Prabhupada is, you know, praising its use in a very practical way. And also very interesting, in astrology a man is considered fortunate who has great wealth, very good sons and a very good wife. Of these three, one who has good wealth is considered to be the most fortunate.
A good wife.
And you know, good wife means don't be enamored by so-called beauty and other attractive features for sense gratification. You know, it's this disposition, you know, like Beauty and the Beast. I just went and did a home program, and the children watched Beauty and the Beast on the video as I was driving. You know, and she falls in love with the beast. Because although he is, you know, very ferocious looking on the outside, she realizes that there is a very beautiful person within. The disposition is beautiful. Whereas the other person, Gaston, who was the great hunk of a man, was actually a beast within, and he wanted to do harm to everyone. Like this. So, but you can see these things astrologically. Some things are very difficult to see without using astrology. You know, you can look at a person sometimes and be very, you know, and that's the problem. You can look at a man or a woman and it's very difficult to know what's inside. You know, especially for the untrained, as most people are. Astrologically, you have a look and say, oh, you know, this is good, this is not, within 10 seconds. So, now, one question also, what's the advantage of worshipping the Supreme Person for material enjoyment? Now, as Prabhupada mentions, Kadama could have asked this benediction from Uma, as recommended even in the Bhagavatam, but he preferred to worship the Supreme Lord. Now, what's the advantage there? Yes.
Just by the process of doing that, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You might start out learning something, but as you worship Krishna, that becomes the focus. So
yes.
You forget about what you even want to do.
Yes. That's right. It's he will gradually become a pure devotee and have no more material hankering. That statement, that exact summary statement in the purport to verse 15. He will gradually become a pure devotee and have no more material hankering. You know, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes a very interesting statement here and that is that when we're awarded something, by the Supreme Lord, even for material enjoyment. In other words, sometimes the Supreme Lord understands that if the devotee, this particular devotee, does not get a certain level of material enjoyment, this devotee will be so disturbed they'll go away. And therefore he offers that material enjoyment. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that that material enjoyment that the Lord offers does not carry karmas. So it's not like receiving, you know, blessings from the demigods, or as a result, or even though it's not like others who enjoy material enjoyment. So if a materialistic person enjoys a certain amount of material enjoyment, sense gratification, and a devotee enjoys the same level but awarded by the Lord, the difference is that that level enjoyed by the devotee does not carry karma. You know, it's something directly given by the Supreme Lord to satisfy that devotee, to keep them fixed in their devotional service. The other thing is that, you know, the devotee is always aware that Krishna has awarded this. You know, when you go before the deity and you pray, you know, dear Lord, you know, I would like to have a nice wife, or you know, some people go to the Holy Dham and they pray, you know, dear Lord, I'd like to have a nice husband like this. The difference is that you're actually remembering, you're seeing the transcendental form of the Lord, which is spiritual. And if the Lord awards that, then you're also remembering that Supreme Lord. Whereas if you approach a demigod, then you're meditating upon a material personality from the start to the end and getting a material result. And so, you know, similarly, you know, a child may want some, let's say, sense gratification in the form of, oh, you know, I want treats, I want treats, I want lollies, I want cake, you know, like this. So, if they go about it associating with similarly minded children, there's not a lot of benefit. They'll just, you know, indulge themselves and, you know, make themselves sick. If they approach the parent may say, yes, okay, all right, I'll make you a cake and you can have some biscuits like that. But along with that, there's a little bit of, but you know, I want to make sure you brush your teeth, and, you know, if you eat too many, you're going to get a bit. There's always the opportunity to get a little, a few drops of wisdom in there, and, you know that the person's looking after your benefit, like that. So when you're dealing with Krishna, it's like that yes, he's giving, but it means that he's always there, and that means you're always going to hear the good instructions as well, you know, and you're going to be meditating on his form and like this. So it's actually far more beneficial to always associate with Krishna, even though one has material desires to fulfill that one may actually be approaching Krishna for. You know, you see that in some extreme cases where parents, I've seen on the news, where parents whose children are addicted to, you know, heroin, and they're killing themselves. And what they're doing is they go out into the street and they use infected needles. They get their fix with associating with all sorts of persons of dubious character, literally killing themselves. And the parents have actually sometimes said, you stay home and I'll get you drugs. And actually, the person is better off. The person, you know, is better off because they're safer. There is some chance there is less chance of harm coming to them, and there is some chance of rehabilitation. So, you know, it's like that with Krishna. Yes.
But that means that, okay, the devotee doesn't get any karma for that. But then the desire still remains. That means the devotee still is addicted to that desire and it may not go away because he's drowned in the desire and he's enjoying it.
Well, it works out in different ways. So, for instance, sometimes we really want something. And we think we're going to be happy when we get it. And what happens is, you know, Krishna knows, well, you won't, but I have to give it to you, otherwise it'd be a bigger problem. So, and then what happens is when we get a certain thing, we realize, oh, actually it wasn't all everything it cracked up to be. You know, it's now I've got it, I can understand. You know, I really wanted something that wasn't going to make me, you know, as happy as, you know, what I thought. So, in that sense, but it is in a very controlled environment, and as a, you know, with Krishna always keeping the devotee within the realms of always hearing good instruction, being able to compare what the material desires that they're having fulfilled with the Krishna conscious desires that they're having fulfilled, and thinking, well, I wanted this, thinking it was so much better than, you know, dancing before the deity. I was thinking, this sounds great, you know, here I'm coming to the temple, I'm dancing, I'm singing like this, and I'm thinking, this is so much better. Now I have it, I understand how wonderful it is to be free to sing and dance, you know, with like that. So therefore, you know, in many different ways, Krishna very cleverly arranges it in such a way that the devotee actually doesn't keep coming back, or more, like that. Actually, he arranges it in such a way that the devotee thinks, you know, okay, you know, on second thoughts, I'm really happy with the life, you know, this that Krishna's offering me this, and I just want more of that. And sometimes, if a devotee doesn't, you know, take that, you know, their intelligence may be really disturbed. You know, there may be excessive problems that, you know, Krishna may reveal to the devotee, you know, in a relatively short period of time, the extent of suffering that a certain thing actually has, you know, that is also, you know, possible. You know, therefore, it describes when Krishna is really, really kind to his devotees, sometimes he takes everything off them, you know, and they just, and Prabhupada said that happened to him. You know, he was, you know, no family, no children, no money, you know, elderly, on his own, that, no business, you know. Krishna took everything failed. And he had no other choice. Krishna left him no other choice except to just surrender to Krishna and follow that one path. That was the only path that was left, you know, open to Prabhupada. You know, Krishna deals with it in different ways. But I have read in the seventh canto, you know, like we hear that when Krishna is really merciful to a devotee, he takes everything off that devotee, off that person. But in the seventh canto, somewhere in the purport there, Prabhupada mentions that, you know, although Krishna says that, he also shows great mercy to a devotee who's somewhat stable in their Krishna consciousness by awarding them everything. You know, so it's not that, you know, if I ever become very sincere about my Krishna consciousness, then Krishna will have to take everything off me. You know, it's not like that. Prabhupada is mentioning that No, if you become very, very sincere in Krishna consciousness, Krishna may award you everything, knowing that you will utilize everything in Krishna's service. So I think the example is in regard to Yudhisthira Maharaj. Now they did, and also in Prabhupada, you know, it's the second stage of the first. Sometimes Krishna does take, you know, or makes one struggle for a long period without, and then when, you know, the devotee just becomes, you know, follows the narrow path that Krishna leaves them, and Krishna is satisfied that they're stable on that path, then he gives them more, you know, everything. So therefore you see Srila Prabhupada, Krishna took everything off, but then he gave him so much more than the little he took off. Now Yudhisthira Maharaj, you know, the Pandavas, everything was taken off them, and then Krishna gave them back so much, you know, practically the demigods were, their opulence rivaled the demigods. So Krishna deals with the devotees in many, many different ways, and ultimately, you know, he's very clever, and he he does deal with it in such a way that if you just keep sticking with Krishna, ultimately you become a pure devotee, and the desires, you know, for material enjoyment subside. That's the way Krishna deals with this. If you just keep associating, he has so many tricks up his sleeve to deal with this. So, and this is what he's doing. This is the purport here of this story of Kadama Muni. This is what he's doing with Kadama Muni. Krishna's quite happy, you know. And, you know, very interesting point also, where it says that ultimately we have to understand who can be freed from the primary necessities of the material body. That's one of the questions. And, you know, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport to verse 17, only by drinking the nectar of chanting and hearing the pastimes of the Lord can one forget the intoxication of material existence. So, you know, you have to understand this second part of it, that, you know, when Krishna deals with us in such a way as to dampen our desire for material enjoyment, one of the prime ways he is doing it is not so much by just making us suffer or by taking things off us or sometimes awarding it. One of the main things he's doing is constantly awarding us transcendental nectar. And devotees become so intoxicated with that, nectar of, that's there, that they're tasting in their devotional service, associating with devotees, chanting Hare Krishna, dancing, singing, living a life where they're, free from karma. They're not expecting that they'll take some horrible birth. You know, they know that they're going to get some wonderful, wonderful opportunity in the next life. Or, you know, they're expecting they may even go back to Godhead. The optimism that Krishna gives his devotees, you know, taking the anxiety. You know, most non-devotees are filled with anxiety. I'm going to die, and then if they believe in reincarnation and karma, what will happen? All that's gone from a devotee. So it's a great sense of happiness, you know. And then, you know, even with that mental, understanding, that intellectual understanding, then, there's so much prasadam, and there's gulab jamuns, and there's pakoras, and chutney, and sweet rice, and you're sitting there, and you're eating, you know, with devotees, and you eat so much, and then you start laughing, and you're rolling on the floor, and then someone throws a gulab jamun at you, and you throw one back at them. You know, there is, Krishna does give you so much in your devotional life that you become so intoxicated, enjoying the intoxication of that Krishna consciousness, that other things, you know, lose their interest. So, in this way, therefore, we see that Kadama Muni, you know, he prays that, you know, I'd like a good wife, but he also is praying that he wants to continue his devotional service. Those two go hand in hand. They can go hand in hand. In verse 17, as it described, why did Kadama Muni want to enjoy material life in spite of his personally seeing and experiencing the Supreme Lord? Not everyone is competent to be liberated, but in that purport there's other very interesting statements. It's everyone's duty, therefore, to enjoy according to his present position, but under the direction of the Lord and the Vedas. Later in that purport he says one should live a life of piety, follow the religious rules and regulations, marry and live peacefully for elevation to higher status of spiritual realization. So actually it's our duty that according to our station we should live piously, follow the rules and regulations, and enjoy both materially and spiritually as allotted by the Lord. No, if that is, say, devotees, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat eating, they avoid 10 offences, they chant 16 rounds, but within that, according to their situation, sometimes the Lord happily awards, well, reluctantly, but still awards them material enjoyment for them to, it's their duty to accept that and enjoy it. Because the Lord awards it in circumstances where it makes that devotee stable and they're progressing, you know, safely on the spiritual path. That's the thing. If a devotee is safe on the spiritual path and making progress, then that material enjoyment which they may crave, which the Lord awards, is not condemned. If a devotee is awarded or they're accepting material enjoyment beyond what's allotted to the Lord, in other words, they're stepping outside of the codes of piety and the rules and regulations, that's how you know. And by enjoying that material enjoyment, their spiritual life is being hampered. That's a different thing. So we should not be envious. Sometimes some devotees, we see, you know, sometimes you see that some devotees are awarded a lot of material enjoyment, and sometimes devotees may just, oh, that person's an enjoyer. You know, but, you know, what we should be looking at is that, yes, you know, that person may be enjoying, but it appears that they're very steady, you know, they're very safe in devotional service, and they tend to be making solid progress forward. So, you know, it's wrong to then say that that person is an enjoyer. It's not condemned. They may not be as elevated as others who are more detached, but, you know, we shouldn't too condescendingly... It's actually their medicine. You know, for instance, if you give one child some medicine, you give the bitter medicine, and you say, take this tablet, very bitter, and the child takes it.
Ah.
Yes. And then you give to another child, and no, I'm taking that, get the, like this. That. And then you put the same medicine in some candy. You say, now take, and then you say, oh, you're eating sweets, you horrible little child. You know. It's, no, you're thinking, the medicine is there, and they're not condemned. Yeah. The medicine will act. So, you know, it is like that. You know, therefore, with our children and men with their wives, you know, and some wives with their husbands. You know, one has to think very, very carefully how the Lord is dealing with those persons, and you know, what is their level of realization and you know, detachment, and you know, very carefully, you know, not make them run away from the medicine by making things too difficult for them. Always attract people to take the medicine of Krishna consciousness. As Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, I brought the medicine, you know, the chain. So, you know, we attract them to take that medicine. That medicine will act. We should be very careful of making things so difficult, harsh, you know, dry, that they don't even want to associate and not even take the medicine. And that sometimes, we have actually seen that with children growing up in Krishna consciousness. You know, the parents are trying to make it too difficult for them. You know, let them enjoy to some degree being children, so that they become very attached to always being around devotees chanting. And at the same time, you know, making sure that they are making some solid progress, you know. That. And, you know, for one's wife, for one's husband, that. And relatives. You know, devotees are sometimes too hard on their relatives. You know, the mother and father, who, you know, not devotees at all, and their cousins, you know, brothers and sisters, who don't even want to know about devotional service. And sometimes the devotees make it so hard for them to even have a relationship with them. But, you know, you make it easy so that they associate with you, and somehow or another they're getting prasad and chanting and everything like that. But, you know, there's so many nice considerations. You know, in the beginning of our movement, you know, one of the main criticisms of this movement was that all over the world we had the worst publicity because people thought that we were extremely austere with our families, with no family attachment. And basically we had no connection to society and weren't offering anything to society. Just people had a very narrow vision. Some devotees, in one sense, because the movement was very neophyte and they weren't necessarily following or understanding Prabhupada's, you know, culture, they were doing some practices which were not bona fide, which actually didn't help. I remember when I was we went on Padayatra in New Zealand. We were going country town to country town, city to city, doing big festivals with my Guru Maharaj, Indrajumna Swami. We stayed at a beach one time. It was very early in the morning. You know, we were all camping, very cold, and I heard this child, you know, crying. It was probably just a couple of years old, and I thought, oh, you know, someone's going to surely go and get that child. There's something wrong out there. And it went on and on and on. I thought, oh, you know, so I got up and I went out. It was very, very cold. And the father had the child, you know, standing on some log thing and pouring icy cold water over this 2-year-old child. And the child, you know, absolutely screaming his head off. And the father's going, no, you have to learn to practice, you have to, you know, learn to become Krishna conscious, you know, 2-year-old child. So that doesn't help our movement, but they obviously not reading the books, you know. Our philosophy is not like that. What's that? That was that would have been 19 about 80 about 80s maybe about 88 1988 something. Yes, the Western devotees can be like that. Yeah. Yes, they can. They yeah, that's a fact. That's a fact.
The Indian groups have much more respect.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, therefore, you know, you see how Krishna adjusts. One thing I've noticed is that, you know. Having such a solid congregation of devotees from an Indian background, you know, the cultural aspect is counteracting a lot of the lack of culture that, you know, we do have in the West, and that's made what I've seen that do is that the devotees who come to Krishna consciousness tend to be more stable as a result over longer periods of time, whereas before we had such a strong Indian congregation, I noticed that people would, you know, come and go in 6 months periods. You know, it was a long time for people sometimes to stay, 6 months, a year, 2 years, they were gone. People tend to come and stay because, you know, that cultural aspect gives them a lot more support, and it's you say not as rigorous and austere. And I've seen also that the Indian congregation have benefited from the Western devotees in that I did notice in the early days that many of the Indian devotees were a little bit more spectator. You know, they would stand and watch. The Prabhupada commented himself that, you know, the one thing he noticed about many of the Indian people when he was trying to establish Krishna consciousness is that they all had so many ideas. Yes, they're all giving so many ideas, but no one would do anything practically. He couldn't get the Indian people to actually get, but can you do something? Can you give me one of your sons to train? Can you come and help me? Can you, you know, do something practically? You know, there was a lot of a lot of ideas and spectating and watching and, you know, commenting like that. I noticed that, you know, the Western devotees in general, they were good at that. There's something needs to be done, bang, bada bing, bada boom, they're in, they get it done, you know, and whatever it is, you know, they get prepared to roll their sleeves up and get their hands dirty. So, you know, both cultures, you know, whereas with the stability within the Indian families, it's like, oh, you know, I'd like to come, but, you know, mum wants me home, you know, the family, you know, for the Indian people to leave the home, the children, the wife, the family, is very difficult sometimes. You know, there's a lot of, you've got your responsibilities like this, and whereas the Western devotees, you know, see ya, you know, they'll just walk out. It doesn't matter what's that, they'll just, you know, walk out on any, I'm going to the temple, I'm going to go do this. So, in that way, the Western devotees are getting the stability from the Indian community, and the Indian community are able to break away from their stability and just spontaneously serve without those family restraints. So, those are good, you know, it's good for both. Alright. I think we'll just leave it at this point. I just one of the last verses we'll look at is explain how the wheel of time cannot touch his devotees. We were saying that, you know, one of the aspects of course, which makes a devotee very happy is that, as it describes here, it cannot take away the life of those who are engaged in devotional service. You know, a devotee has a mentality that every day they're coming close to eternality. They're coming, you know, they're getting closer to living the life of eternality, and never really, and even the one death that we may have to face, or we will have to face in this life, even that's been assured that it can happen like lightning. You know, you leave the body, your water is, if you, you know, so. You know, that sense of, isn't that one of the greatest fears that people have, you know, impending death? To take that out of a devotee's life, it must be a sense of joy and happiness, you know. You know, I don't have to, you know, rot in material existence for millions and millions of lifetimes, according to my karma, which no one can get out of, you know. I know sometimes I've had this dream where someone has attacked someone, like my daughter or something, and I've had to kill that person. You know, I've had this dream, and then, you know, there was no way out. The person was going to kill my daughter, and I've had to kill them. And then in the dream, you know, I got sentenced to the rest of my life in jail. And I've had it like a few times. And I thought, you know, and then I'm thinking, oh, you know, hellish. The rest of my life, I'll never go to the temple again. I won't see, you know. And then I wake up. And when I wake up, I'm still sad. Going to jail. And then I think, hang on. I'm in death. It didn't happen. You know, you get those dreams. It didn't actually happen. I think, I'm free. And then, you know, I think, ah. That's actually the sense that a devotee should have. You know, you're free. You know? It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity that we have that others don't. These are the gifts that Krishna gives us. Where if we go back full to sense gratification, we have to forfeit those gifts. You know, if we say, oh, Krishna, I just really want a lot of sense. Yes, okay, but you will have to take repeated birth and death to enjoy that. So then, you know, gradually you weigh up. Freedom? Prison. Freedom? Yeah. And after some time it dawns on you. Prison, of course! You know. No, freedom. You take the freedom. All right, so we can leave it there. And next time we meet, hopefully we'll have our room and we'll have some more time. And we will continue from verse 21, really. You know, from 21 through to 30 again, you know, very interesting section, you know, how leaving the fulfillment of our desires, you know, entrusting that to the Supreme Lord. Again, it's, you know, continues on from where we're leaving off. Very nice section. Mm. Right. Yeah, does anyone want to select? No? No? Paul, you want to chat that? You can, if anyone wants, they can select. Did you see the options? No, I'll just show you the sheet. Basically, everyone can choose one of the chapters. You'll see. Because we have about 15 people, there'll probably be only about 3 for each section. There's 5 chapters. So once we get 3, you may have to choose another one, unless, you know, I can consider it. But it's good to get in as soon as you can when you decide that there's a certain chapter you want. that you really want to do, get in before two or three others take it.
Quite everywhere we have any points there.
What's that?
You could cover in a class, in a presentation, there's so many points.
There's a lot of points, yeah. And
you can get that into...
You don't necessarily have to cover everything. It's not, you know, it's not possible, but you will have to, you know, some of the main issues, like, you know, there's a lot of points in the purports that we've just covered, but we really tried to stick to a real theme, you know, in this. Yeah. Yeah, so if you can do that, the overall chapter, you know, try and cover the theme, and any real tricky points, like this was a tricky point, it is something where there's two different views of the same subject given. So you really, you to leave that out and not clarify it, would be, you'd probably lose marks, you know. It definitely has to be sorted out in the presentation. So you don't have to cover everything and all the points, but it should be the main things, and any real tricky things, significant things should be covered. No, so about three people, can choose one topic, and they do an individual presentation. Yeah, 40 minutes. Yeah, 40. I think it's 30. I was 40. I reduced it to 30. Yeah. What's that?
It was 20 minutes plus 10 minute questions.
Yeah, yeah. So 20 and 10 minutes questions, something like that. But basically 30 minutes. Yeah. So. As soon as we finish the section, we'll do this and then we'll do the exam after that. Are you going away? When are you going? Yeah. I'm trying to cover one chapter a week. I'm struggling to cover one chapter a month at the moment because of all the interruptions, you know. The transcendental interruptions, but interruptions nonetheless. So, you know, next week when we cover this topic, the rest of the chapter I will go over a little bit more briefly than what I covered this first section. But I'm giving you a bit of a sample. I don't want to cover the whole thing. I'm giving you a sample of how to deal with the thing. I'll go over the rest of the chapter, but a lot more briefly than what I went over this first part of it. So I'll leave it to the students who are doing it to investigate it themselves. Don't want to do all the work for them. If you're going to do this chapter and you have specific questions, next week's the time to ask. So we should be doing chapter 22 next week. So study chapter 22, because I'll briefly go over chapter 21. And then we want to actually try and get the whole of chapter 22 done as well. So 22, next week, 23, 24. So it's 20, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 24, all right? So we did 22, 3, and 4. So I'd like to finish it in 3 weeks and then literally start the presentations. And we may have to, you know, put aside a little bit more extended time in the course of a Saturday, or something to get everyone in so that we're not going on for several months with the presentations, try and, you know, group them in over a weekend or, you know, two at the most or something. So that'd be all right. So you should still be here? Yeah? Is that good news?
Yeah,
that's good. Yeah.